Today, the first of 10 maxims for Christians.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
And when I say for Christians, by the way, I do not mean only Christians should listen to this. I do mean 10. So in the past, when we were on the radio, actually, and for, you know, years and years, I did a couple of times, I did a series called 10 Commandments of a Christian Worldview, back then we called it. Not so much of a worldview, and I should think about it differently and talk about it differently, I think. And so I'm calling it 10 Commandments for Christians, but it's not really commandments. I mean, they are. They're all imperatives. But they're maxims. They are, I hope, handier tools for understanding the essentials that underlie Christianity. And again, I think these would be helpful to anyone, whether you claim to be a Christian or not, that they would help to understand some of the, not all, but some of the delimiters for Christianity. On this side of the line, you can say, yes, that's Christian. And on the other side of the line, I think you pretty much have to say, no, that's not Christian. That's what I mean by 10 maxims for Christians. And I don't just mean for Christianity. I mean for believers. If they're going to claim to be believers, they should have in their tool bag of ideas these ideas as well. So they are essential maxims, I think. And so I want to explain one more thing about this before we actually jump into number one and then start going through the 10. This is going to be probably 10 episodes or maybe a few more. I'm not sure. And I don't know whether they'll be sequential or not. We may interrupt them a few times and things like that. But I want to get started with it. But before I start on the first maxim itself, I want to make a point about how lists like this are risky. They're always risky because I don't want some surreptitious way to imbue Christianity with kind of a litmus test. I've done that in the past. I used to live there. And if you want to go back and listen to any of my personal background, confessional repentance type shows, I'm sure we can find a whole list of them in previous episodes. I don't want a list like that. You know, when I was actually in seminary and then here at Criswell College working on my MDiv, I think a lot of how I understood the education I was getting was with that ability to have a sensitivity to key words and ideas in background that would reveal that somebody wasn't holding Christianity the only way it really ought to be held. And so I could be judgmental about people in a way that other people just didn't understand because they didn't know the magic words that revealed the corruption that lay underneath, blah, blah, blah. I've realized since then, and it is a realization, not just a change of mind, how surreptitious that was. To hold a magic key or code that would allow me to designate someone as inferior in the Christianity they held because they just didn't understand the repercussions of the language they were using. This is not like that. These are not maxims that you can use to judge someone else's Christianity secretly and find out that they really are servants of some scheme or some, you know, conspiracy to undermine blah, blah, blah. It's not that at all. It's a way for us to look at ourselves. It's a way for you to look at the claims someone might be making and say, yeah, I can use that. Or, no, I don't think that would be compatible with the fundamental claims of Christianity. Just the fundamental ideas that lie underneath Christianity. And so that's what I want to create. And there's, again, there's always a risk when we're creating our own list of things we refer to as essential, which I am referring to this that way, and that can become our test, sort of our litmus test of whether you fit the culture or not, that we have to be careful about. As a simple example, and a really important example, and one that matters, one that actually defines the second of the maxims that I'll give to us later on about the value of human life. That's what we'll be talking about in the second maxim. This is a good example of how it can become confused when we take our essentials as a way to determine whether something is still Christian or not and make a mistake about it. So in this example, I would say, you know, the ethics that go with the value of life, the sanctity of human life, which I do think is built into how Scripture describes human beings and how Christianity is supposed to take the value of human life. In the New Testament and Old Testament, it's scattered everywhere, that value, that ethic of life, which is simple to describe, and I will do, again, when we get to the second maxim that we'll be talking about. If you confuse the ethics that goes with life, human life, with the politics that goes with a particular way of enforcing or understanding or expressing the value of that life, then that confusion can create actually a bifurcation or a belligerence that's entrenched in our way of thinking about the world that leads us to some absurd conclusions. And it has done exactly that over the last 50 years or so in the expressions, political expressions that have been given to the sanctity of life. Not necessarily the ethical expressions. There are differences, divergences regarding the ethic as well, and that can be important. But it's important that we not allow the essentials that I'm going to be talking about now as we talk about the essential maxims that Christians ought to hold, or 10 commandments for Christians that we ought to recognize. It's important that they not become somehow substitutes for the real quality and value of what's expressed in Scripture about the way, you know, Christians, believers, ought to think about the world. So part of the reason I do want to do this, I don't want to be surreptitious about, you know, inserting this certain political perspective or cultural perspective, but I do want to do it because there are some things that are essential to Christianity. There are things without which Christianity would not be what it is. My students always sort of cross their eyes when I define what an essence is, that without which a thing cannot be what it is. When you define essence that way, you know, it's got all those negatives in it, it becomes very confusing and twisty. It leaves people cross-eyed sometimes, but that is what I'm talking about here. There are things without which Christianity would not be Christianity, and I want to make sure we hold on to those. You know, if you take Plutarch's Ship of Theseus, which you've heard of before, the Ship of Theseus paradox, you know, where you have a ship and you're, you know, charged with taking care of it, and you replace one piece at a time, and if it, by, you know, by the end of a long period of time, you've replaced all the pieces, one board at a time, one nail at a time, one post at a time, you replace everything until every single board is new. There was no point at which it wasn't still the ship. It's always been the ship. Does it still belong to its original owner or not? There's not a single piece of that original ship that's in the ship that's in front of you. And yet it just morphed over time into this new thing so that it's still the old thing. I don't want that to be what we do with Christianity. I don't want us, a piece at a time, to replace the thing that Jesus actually gave us, what he actually demonstrated when he was in the world, what he left for us could easily be replaced one board at a time, one edict at a time, one practice at a time, one song at a time, one verse at a time, to become something that's not at all what it was he intended to leave for us. And I don't want to discover that we name our boat Christian only to discover it stopped being Christian a long time ago. And there are obvious things in here. I mean, the supernaturalism that's built into it. There is something miraculous and beyond the material world. That'll be built into our discussion about the fourth commandment. The fourth commandment having to do with the Sabbath. You know, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. These are not, by the way, 10 maxims that are a reflection of the 10 commandments, but they do relate to the 10 commandments. It's not mysterious or surprising that if God gives 10 commandments in the Old Testament, it actually refers to them as somehow significant or important, and then refers to them again in the New Testament. It's not surprising that they would be anchored in or attached in some way to some particularly important ideas in the history of Judaism and Christianity. So these do relate to it. So, anyway, what I was saying is, an essential like supernaturalism, which we won't refer to as that. That's not a maxim. We'll create a maxim about it. We'll get to it when we get to it. It's part of the fun. For me, it's fun. I don't know. For you, it's just a thing. But whatever. I hope it'll be fun for you also. But when we get, or the resurrection. There's no sense in talking about Christianity without the resurrection, which, by the way, leads to an understanding of what makes this first maxim so important as well. Because in the resurrection is the declaration of the lordship of Jesus. And there's no sense in talking about something being Christian. And I don't mean having some Christian characteristics. Of course, things can have characteristics of Christianity and not be Christian. That's fine. I mean literally Christian. I mean about the thing it means for us to be Christians altogether. Are we still that? And believing in the resurrection is such an essential part of what Christianity has always been that if we were to lose it, you know, we'd have a problem. And that, again, sort of opens the door for us to come into the conversation on this first maxim. And the way it comes into it, in case I don't come back to it later on more specifically in this first episode about the 10 maxims or commandments for Christians, the way it leads into it is through the lordship of Jesus. The thing the resurrection demonstrates most clearly, the thing Peter is expounding in the sermon at Pentecost after the resurrection, is that Jesus is Lord. That's why that utterance, Jesus is Lord, becomes the fundamental utterance of Christianity. It's not all of the other doctrinal statements. It's not all of the other attachments we could put to it. And it's not all of the other ethics that go with it that are most fundamental to Christianity. I value all of those, especially the ethics that go with Christianity. But the most fundamental element of Christianity is the simple declaration, truth, that Jesus is Lord, which is made most abundantly clear. It is declared, revealed from the heavens in the act of God raising his son from the dead. So the resurrection's just built into Christianity. And once you say, you know, I don't really believe in the resurrection, then it might be that you embrace a Christian ethic. It might be that you have a Christian culture. It might be that you participate in a Christian church, but it would not be that you are satisfying the very essence of Christianity, which includes the resurrection. I'm not trying to give that as a litmus test right now. It has been historically the litmus test, the lordship of Jesus, belief in the resurrection. That's it. If you believe that God raised him from the dead and confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, that's the statement of soteriology, of salvation, in the book of Romans, for instance. So it's pretty obvious that it would be the case. Okay, well, I'm defending myself too much. The point here is that I want to give 10, I think, simple maxims. I would encourage you to take these along this line. This would be something that if you had a reference card you carried around with you and said, you know, how am I supposed to think about that? That you could just look at these statements and go, oh, yeah, I remember this. But these are so simple, I think so direct. You wouldn't need to write them down on a reference card. It's not like I would expect someone to go around and be able to quote the Ten Commandments for Christians. It's just an opportunity to converse about things, which I think when the opportunity arises for their consideration, these sayings being in our minds should help us say, oh, yeah, no, that's too important. I can't give that one up. This is just a fundamental part of what it means to be the kind of theist that would claim to be Christian. And that statement, theist, you know, that opens the door to the first maxim, which is this, by the way, this is the maxim I would put in place. The Lord is as important as you are not. And so there's the maxim, there's the commandment. The Lord is as important as you are not. That's how we should think about the world. No way to get around it. Now, obviously, the ideas behind that are present in the first three of the actual, you know, Old Testament Ten Commandments that Moses receives on Mount Sinai. The first three of those commandments, taking the language of Exodus 20, God speaks all these words, I'm quoting Exodus 20 now, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And then the commandments begin in verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. And then verse 4, you shall not, this is the second command in verse 4, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that's in heaven above or that's in the earth beneath or that's in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You, he goes on to say, the third commandment, shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. All of this establishing a place, a position for God in our way of thinking that says we're supposed to recognize how important he and only he is. The Lord is, and then that other statement, as important as you are not. And there's a reason that I'm putting that in the equation of this maxim. If you take Exodus 20, the first two of the Ten Commandments, just those first two statements in verses 3 and 4 in particular, that this commandment, the Lord is as important as you are not, is a way of summarizing those two statements. Or in Deuteronomy 5, when it words it there, the two commandments, you know, have no other gods before me, and then have no graven images, can also be summarized in a way. It's one of the first time I heard this expression that I'm about to give you, it just made me laugh out loud. I just thought, well, that's a perfect expression of the first two commandments. And they weren't even saying it as the first two commandments, but it really is the first two commandments, which is really simple. There's only one God, and you're not him. That statement, putting any of us into place, into our place, so that we realize that there is a God, there's only one of him, and that we're not him, is just a perfect statement. The Lord is as important as we are not. And then when I put in the third commandment, the one about not taking his name in vain, which, by the way, is not about profanity. It's not about whether we're uttering profanity or not. Again, a discussion for another show. I've done episodes before on profanity, and when we were talking about art in particular, we spent some time talking about profanity and where it does and doesn't fit into civil discourse and so on. I think it's important that we measure the kinds of words that we're willing to use and what it reveals about us and so on. So all of that's an important discussion, but it's not in the third commandment. The third commandment is about whether when you're using God's name, you're actually referring to him. And what makes that third commandment interesting is that it strikes at how fundamental the distinction is between God and us and how important it is for us to maintain that distinction. If you think about it, it's through God's name that we identify him. There's no immediate means for us to grasp his identity otherwise. That's why apophatic theology and the idea of negative theology becomes so appealing, because everything we say about God, categorizing him, pigeonholing him, is obviously errant in some way. Our metaphors are all inadequate in one way or another, and so there is a way that we should understand him that's not graspable by us. So instead, he gives us this sacred name, literally sacred, not to be used profanely or mundanely in everyday usage about the rest of the world, so that when we refer specifically to him, we're referring to him in a way that we would not use to refer to anything else. And because of that, we recognize there's something unique about him, something really important about him that's not true about any of the rest of us, that is uniquely important about him. So that, the severity with which God's name was protected, sort of gives testimony to when the name Yahweh is used in the Old Testament. And I understand that it would be kind of offensive for me just to use the term if I were in a Jewish context, but I'm not. And so we use the term. I think we probably should be careful about when we're willing to use it and how we're willing to use it. But that name is so protected in the Old Testament. I mean, there are times they're drawing fences around it grammatically, literally putting marks in the text to separate the name of God, Yahweh, from something that might be profane in the same verse where his name is used. It's a fairly fascinating reverence for the name Yahweh in the Old Testament. And again, I mean, he gives us the name because I think he wants us to use it in reference to him. So I don't mind using it. But even in Jewish Old Testament practices or in Jewish practices in general, the substitution of a name, Adonai or Hashem, that, you know, literally replacing the name Yahweh with the words the name so that you don't profane the name, or maybe using the name Elohim or the word Elohim in place of Yahweh. Using any of that in those Old Testament or Jewish practices is all testimony to just how severely we're supposed to regard the name of God as identifying him uniquely. All of that is a way of saying we have this one particular tool for recognizing the uniqueness of God, and we should protect it. That's a way of saying the Lord is really important, and how we regard him matters. Not to do so in some way to diminish him to our level is not to understand who God is at all. And that's part of the discussion for today. The contrast, literally, just the contrast between God's exaltation, as we describe it in so many different ways, and our diminution, putting us lower and lower while we exalt him. Basically, the definition of worship, that we lower ourselves constantly and we exalt him. This last Sunday, I preached from Psalm 103. It's a psalm I've preached 100 times before. I love the psalm, and the previous Bible, I actually finally bought a new Bible not too long ago because mine was falling apart. And it was, I didn't have an ESV. I didn't have a single actual copy of the ESV, meaning paper copy of the ESV. What's wrong with me? Because I use the ESV when I normally preach. I just normally preach from tablet. You don't care about any of that. My point is to get to say, when I was preaching Psalm 103 this time, I sort of reorganized everything. I needed to be a little briefer because there was a translation going on at the same time and so on. But it's just so rewarding to preach that text, and I'll share it with you at some point. We'll do an episode on Psalm 103, because it has, in the beginning and end, it is, "Bless the Lord, O my soul." That's the key statement, the opening and closing utterance of the psalm. But in between it, there's all the goodness that he has toward us, the mercy he has on our sinfulness, the compassion he has for our weakness, because we're perishing human beings. We're like a flower in a field that dies, and then the hole in the ground where the flower used to be doesn't even remember that the flower used to be there. That's how diminished we are in our significance being described in that psalm. And yet it's a psalm that then immediately rises to the level of God's exaltation over every part of creation. He is above and over everything. That contrast, God ruling over everything and men passing away so abruptly the earth can't even remember that they were here, that contrast is what we're supposed to bring into our understanding of who God is. The Lord is as important as we are not. It's built into the nature of our forgiveness. And just think about this. For us to grasp that God is not fazed, F-A-Z-E-D, he's not fazed by our moral failures, it's challenging for us. We despise ourselves to, you know, once we've recognized that we actually have had a moral failing, we can despise ourselves to the point that we really don't understand or grasp how on earth God could possibly forgive us. And then we fail, you know, in the language we like to use about ourselves, we fail to forgive ourselves, to put it in psychological rather than judicial or forensic terms. We fail to forgive ourselves. It's less of a statement about how sufficiently we recognize our guilt, although it is partially that, but then it is more of a statement about how insufficiently we grasp the superiority of God. The truth that God is so much greater than us can change our understanding of how capable God is of not only forgiving us, but also of changing us. Oh, I don't think I can ever be. Our doubt in ourselves isn't as much a statement about ourselves as it is a statement about our lack of understanding God's greatness. That's the reality of it. It's one of the maxims that we'll bring up much later, God's ability to change human beings, which, believe me, is one of the most difficult maxims for me to hold, because I understand how rigidly we're fixed in the systems. Well, to finish the sentence, in which we're fixed. Okay, so anyway, in any circumstance, God is so much greater than we are. Jeremiah has beautiful language for it. We know the self-loathing Jeremiah. I can really identify with the guy. I realize now, when I was in high school, especially in college, and I had such a difficult time reading the book of Jeremiah, I really had a hard time trudging through it. Every single time I read through the Bible, I'd get to Jeremiah and it was just a mud pit. I realize now how much of that was just how commonly I could associate with his expressions in a way that wasn't pleasant. It was sort of drudging up thoughts I had about myself anyway. And Jeremiah, you know, in a self-loathing way, at least recognizes how far above all of that God is in his very nature. In Jeremiah 32, a couple of expressions of it, you know, in the New Covenant kinds of sections of Jeremiah. Ah, Lord God, he said, it is you who have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and your outstretched arm. You could even, going back to previous episodes we've had, think of Job recognizing this, although he might not have said it. He would put his hand over his mouth, right? Nothing is too hard for you, Jeremiah says. You show steadfast love to thousands, but you also repay the guilt of fathers to the children after them. Oh, great and mighty God, whose name is the Lord of hosts. This is who you are on either side, so far greater above us. In Jeremiah 32:26, just later, 8 verses later or so, the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah and said, behold, I am Yahweh, I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is anything too hard for me? That expression that, you know, makes its way into the New Testament as well. Is anything too hard for me? Of course, that's the point. Nothing is too hard for God. He can feed a nation in the wilderness. This is the idea that when we recognize that the Lord is as great as we are not, that we recognize that he is as kind as we are not, that he is as important as we are not, then we're grasping a fundamental in our faith. The reason I think this maxim is so important, at least one of the reasons I think this maxim is so important, is that there's, in our practical lives, there is a common contrast between what we actually think and what actually is the case. At least in our faith, what we should admit is the case. So the way, and I've had, again, previous episodes about this entirely, so I won't try to rehash the details of it, but, you know, Western culture used to be theistic. The world was replete with meaning and purpose. It was a stage in which we were acting. And I don't want to go back to that. I'm not asking to go back to thinking of the world as a stage and we're just play actors that God has put down here to play through the drama that he's written for us. I don't want the whole metaphor to be lived out in our daily way of thinking about the world. But there is something in that that's inescapably important to a theistic way of understanding the world. God has a plan for the world, and it's happening, and we're living in the world for which he has a plan, which means everything that's happening in the world does have meaning. And it also means that everything we experience in this life has a purpose. It doesn't even matter whether we think about it retroactively or prospectively. Whichever direction we're thinking about it, recognizing that God has a purpose for it. You understand what I mean by that? I'm not even saying I have to be able to look back and say, well, I understand why that happened to us. I'm not Job's friends. I don't need to be able to point my finger at someone and say, well, it's not hard to figure out why that happened to you. I don't have to do it retrospectively, but prospectively, I do have to, and Job recognizes this, I do have to admit that if something happened in the world, my job from this point forward is to figure out how I'm supposed to move forward on the premise that God still knows what he's doing. There is some purpose for this. And now, in my obedience, I can demonstrate my faith that God is still God. That's part of recognizing what's going on. That's part of what's built into a theistic world. That's how we understand the world. But what we became in our culture and our way of thinking is not theistic, but deistic. And this is, I'm not condemning the whole thing. There's incredible value in the way we solve problems mechanistically, in the way we address issues using systems and theories and science, basically. I love all of that. I've had whole episodes about that in the past. That's fine. But, you know, when I say we became deistic, I mean in the ugliest possible way. We have decided that God's not really all that involved in the world, that it's a machine that's just functioning. And yeah, he created it, and yes, he can intervene when he wants to on a rare, miraculous occasion where he actually cares about something that's going on here. That's how we think of the world, not what I think about it, not what I want to think about it. But the way we think of the world became deistic. In physics, we, you know, used to think God was holding the planets in his hand, that he had everything under his control. And then we decided, and look, I love physics, so I'm not mocking the concept. I'm saying it's a change in the way we think about the world. So in physics, we used to think, oh, well, God controls every aspect of nature and everything that's happening is happening because he's making it happen right now. And then we decided the moon is just perpetually falling around the earth. It's caught in this balance perpetually between the impersonal force of gravity and the conservation, this impersonal conservation of its forward momentum. The moon just happens to be falling around the earth, and it's going to keep on falling because the center of the earth is down, and the moon just needs to keep falling down, but it also keeps falling away because it's got momentum that's being conserved in its speed and blah, blah, blah. By the way, once you really grasp that picture, if you think all the way through it and realize it's just perpetually falling and it never stops, then you really do stop seeing a need for a personal force to be behind the movement of things like the moon. I'm not prescribing that. I certainly don't want that perspective. But it's hard for us not to think of the world that way. And then what we have to do if we want something to change is ask God to step in and stop the natural forces that are just functioning without his even paying attention to them. And that's how we think of miracles in the world. That's how we've changed our thinking in the world. In biology, we decided animals didn't need to be designed by God, but could be the iterative product of nature's selecting of the fittest for survival. It's a perfectly reasonable explanation of how animals came to be. Given a few billion years to work on it, it makes good sense. I understand why people hold that view. I love reading about evolutionary theory and how it works to explain how certain things behave and so on. But it doesn't change the fact that it changes our way of thinking about the world from one that's theistic to one that is, at best, deistic. And psychology, the same way. We decided the mind is just a brain, and its choices are nothing more than the product of impersonal stimuli that are shaping it. We stop thinking that our solutions are theistic and start thinking of them as mechanistic. You just develop the right model. And again, I'm not even belittling that. I love those models. I love the power that's in science. I love being able to study all of that. I love doing astronomy. I'm not mocking it. I live in that different way of seeing the world just like the rest of us do. I understand that. But it's important that we recognize that when we do that, and when we do the other, by the way, when we're in that theistic perspective, it's easy for us to ascribe things to God that are wrong because we also have sort of a shallow grasp of God's constant and permanent presence in the world because we're not God. We can't comprehend it fully. And so we make some bad judgments and we do some horrible things to each other in the name of God that would not be justifiable if we could think in a more nuanced way. But we're not good at thinking in a nuanced way. So don't hear me saying, oh, if we could just go back to the Middle Ages, you know, that Spanish Inquisition, that was good stuff. I'm not saying that at all. But in any perspective we're going to take up, we're always going to have the problems of being human beings and therefore limiting ourselves to the problems that come with that angle, that way of seeing the world. And so in deism, in our way of seeing the world as a machine that's just functioning, and every once in a while, maybe God gets involved in it again, we unfortunately function as if we're atheists. Now, I'm not even saying we're atheistic. Like, I don't believe in God. Of course you believe in God, but on a day-to-day basis, as I've heard many people describe it, deism is pretty much functional atheism. We accuse atheists of being the fools, you know, like quoting Psalm 53. But that's not really what Psalm 53 is saying, and it's not how it would get to it. The idea expressly stated in Psalm 53 is that the fool says in his heart, there's no God. And that's where I'm saying we say it as deists. Oh, there's no God involved in this. There's no God dealing with this. There's no God keeping my car from starting. I mean, why would you? You just, you know, you work on the car. You plug it into a battery charger. You do whatever you want to do. You know, you're not praying over your car to start. Maybe you are, and good for you. I'm glad you are. But the reality is what we're thinking in our minds is, well, God's not all that involved in this. Now, again, I'm not condemning or condoning except to say when we hold a view like that, we're saying the thing in our heart that's referred to as being fools in Psalm 53. That is, we're justifying behavior, and this is what Psalm 53 is all about. It's about God looking down from heaven to see if there's anybody good here and realizing there's nobody good because everybody's looking up at heaven and saying, I don't think God's going to judge us for doing anything bad, so let's just go do what we want to do. It's not actual atheism, it's functional atheism. I think I can get away with this because I don't think God does anything in the world anymore. That's what we're doing as deists. Go read Psalm 53, the first, you know, four, five, six, well, the whole thing then. In Psalm 53. If you read it, you'll see that's what he's actually condemning. The evidence that we don't, again, I mean it functionally, but that we don't believe in God anymore, and especially, you know, sometimes it's overt. Let's just face it. Sometimes we just plain old don't believe in God. And sometimes subtly we reject the idea of God's activity in the world. But I think always in practice, we're revealing that we think maybe God's taken his hand off the steering wheel. You know, maybe he's not really here anymore. Is evident, and, you know, this condemns us all. It's evident when we try to control the circumstance, when we try to control outcomes rather than demonstrating our faith that God is in control of the circumstance. If you think about it in the Old Testament, you know, when kings in the Old Testament were praying to idols or were forming allegiances rather than turning to God for help, as in 2 Chronicles, they're giving evidence that they don't really have faith that the God who said he could deliver them can deliver them. Either you don't believe God cares about you anymore, that it's a personal affront between you and God, or you just don't think he's actually the one who's there anymore. Maybe you're still a supernaturalist, but you're just not sure Yahweh was the true God, you know, up in the heavens. But it's the same thing, you know, for instance, in denominational life. We've had denominational conflict. I mean, it's Baptist bread and butter, and I'm in the Baptist world, right? Denominational conflict, that's what brings people to a meeting. Nobody's even going to show up if there's nothing about it that's going to be conflictual. I'm coming for the fight, baby. That's what I want to be present for. You know, that's what people show up for. The largest Southern Baptist convention in memory. I don't know, there's like 40,000 people coming to Dallas for the convention. Those numbers may not be exactly right, but they're close. They're in the neighborhood. Came because there was a huge conflict that year. And, you know, every time there's conflict, there are numbers. Now, I know the backroom machinations that were going on in order to try to make this thing happen, this solution happen. We're gonna bend the rules this way. We're going to use a technicality that way. Here, we who believe in democracy among the people of God as an expression of the lordship of Jesus, it's in our doctrinal statement, for crying out loud. We're going to use technicalities to exclude the will of the majority from being considered so that we can get the right result. Why would we do that? Because we don't really believe Jesus is in charge. Because we don't really think he's present. We think it's in our hands to make it happen. And I'm telling you, when we get to that point, which, again, historically, we get to that point a lot. When we get to that point, we're basically not believing in God anymore. No, I think I'm the one who has to do it. And that's not a great place to be. It's where we are in politics in the world, right? Not just right now. It's where we are almost constantly in politics in the world when we try to bring our religion into our political practices. And I understand why we do that. Every time we do the wrong thing to try to get the right result. And by the way, we'll talk a lot more about that when we get to the what. Right now, I may change the order of these as I'm going through them, but would be the seventh maxim about, you know, how to do right, what makes for right. When we get to that one, you'll understand that we're talking about this. When we do the wrong thing in order to get the right result, what we're saying is, I can't really trust God to bring about the right result if I do the right thing. So I'm going to do it my way and solve the problem here. That's what we're doing. And by the way, I'll add on to that one, and this leads us toward the point I want to make at the close of what we're talking about. You know, when we talk about ourselves too seriously, I'm the only one, I'm the person who, when we're doing that, you know, what are we saying about where God fits into the equation? He is as important as we are not. The everyday aspect of this commandment is that while everything about God is dead serious and important, all the stuff about us as people, not so much, you know? An example of that, of how unimportant we are, is whether I personally succeed at something or not, it's not that important. I even learned this in rhetoric. I learned, and I wish I had learned it earlier in life. I was told it plenty of times earlier in life. I was given the example of it in the debating that I did in junior high and high school. You're not trying to persuade the other debate team. You're trying to persuade the judge. What you're doing with the other debate team is just having an interaction so the judge can make their decision. You would think that I would have learned from that, that when I'm having a dispute with someone or an argument with someone or a disagreement with someone, that I don't have to in the moment persuade them. I just make the best case that I can and let it lie and let it take its form later on. And I have learned that people will go and they'll rummage through the ideas and later they might even change their mind. I don't need people to change their mind in the moment. Just learning that, you would think, would have made this point to me that it's not important whether I succeed at something or not. It's not important that I look good when I'm doing something. That doesn't matter at all. I'm a flower that blossoms for a moment and then withers away and the ground doesn't even remember I was there. That's how the Bible describes us. On the other side of that, on the side that says we really are important, an example of how significance can be restored to us despite how unimportant we would be in comparison to God is whether I live out God's mercy, God's goodness. It's hugely important, not because of me, but because of his mercy and goodness. They are so important that it gives me significance. It gives me importance to be a part of that. Yeah, that's why God has chosen to ascribe centrality to man. and I mean humankind, to men and women. He has chosen to ascribe centrality to us. He puts Adam and Eve in the middle of the Garden of Eden, that he puts in the middle of the paradise that he creates in every other act of that creation. Humankind is central to the importance of all things that are created. And then he gives us agency as well. But in that agency, we enact the fall. And the entire, but listen to this, in the fall, God doesn't then say, oh, well, I'll just make them a cockroach and step on them and they'll be done. He doesn't do that. Instead, he makes us the center of the meta-narrative, the whole story of Scripture about redeeming humanity and thereby redeeming the whole of the creation that he had put us at the center of. The point being, understanding that our importance is diminished incredibly when we're put next to God doesn't change the importance of how we are seen next to God. I think, you know, the most neglected truth about God in our current minds is his way of relating to our world. He's the creator. You know, if you put it in Colossians 1, he's the creator. He is the culmination, the concluder of the creation, and he's the current sustainer of the creation. And there's just no getting around how important all of that is. In fact, on the idea of the creator, in Colossians 1, he's the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. By him, all things were created. You know that language. A book I read not too long ago that I mentioned in a couple of episodes previously called The Strangest Man, I've forgotten the subtitle, but it's about Paul Dirac, this brilliant mathematician, theoretical physicist, scientist of the atom, however you want to regard him. Just incredibly brilliant mind, a complete skeptic of religion, completely rejected the ideas of Christianity and theism and religion, wrestled with the questions of God's fit with the universe, principally on the issue of creation and continuation. He wrestled with that fit through the most intense parts of his life. There's just no getting away from it. God's relationship with the creation is paramount. It is critical for us to understand, and it puts him as the important figure in all of it. We come and go. He is the origin and the end and the sustainer in the middle. That's how important he is to us. I wish this weren't the case. So it's the first maxim. Just carry this around in your pocket as the very first thing you think. The opposite of this, to us, we think of him as, you know, once upon a time in a land far away, God created things, and he made this story about Jesus, who in a land far away, and so on. That's how we think of him. God, not a God here and now, the world where we actually live. That's not where he is. He's up there in heaven, which might as well just be a mythological place for us. That's not where he should be in our minds. We should be willing to take the Lord very seriously. But ourselves, not so much. We should be willing to tremble in the presence of God and then laugh at ourselves. Maxim 1, 9 more to come.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.